going to you because I couldn't answer it. So I thought I'd get you to answer it. He asked me a question. How many words are there for sacrifice in the Old Testament and what do they mean? So if anybody wants to take that for a subject, I think it'd be a good subject. How many words are there for sacrifice in the Old Testament? And, the words for sin. How many words for sin in the Old Testament? And what is the particular emphasis of each one? We'll take up one of them today particularly. But there is pesha, you know, for sin, and then there's kata for sin, and you will be told that kata means to miss the mark, and pesha means to rebel, I think, and there's ma'al, and there is, we have one here for today, shagag. So, how many words are for sin? And what is the particular emphasis of each one? I think I'd make a nice little 10-page subject. Anybody want to grab that now, or I'll put it down. Words for sin. Any question on it? You see what I mean? Get plain enough. Okay, will you be making your mind up on these things? And now, how would you go about one like that? How would you find all the different words for sin in the Old Testament? Start with A and go on through? Read Brown Bridle Briggs or something? What would you do? What would you think? Jeff, no? What would you think?
I find out somebody else did the work first.
Oh, yeah, there you are. Look it up in the encyclopedia. Well, that's not a bad place to begin. That's not a bad place to begin with anything in the encyclopedia. I remember when I graduated from seminary that the ISBE, International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, was the thing to use. It was a good one. It's pretty well outdated now. And so you have two to choose from. One is the revised ISBE. Has it been revised? I don't have it revised. It was a long time getting done. I think there were a couple of volumes done, and I'm not sure whether they were even used in the final. But at least the ISBE would be a good place to begin. And another one would be the ZPEB, the Zondervan Encyclopedia of the Bible, Pictorial Encyclopedia of the Bible, ZPEB. And that's a good one. When we were working on the NIV, a bunch of fellows around, maybe 10 fellows around the table, and it comes to a question, ephod. Now, what is the ephod? What does it mean? And how should we translate all that sort of thing? And, look it up in, this is an example, look it up in ZPEB. They looked it up in ZEB and got the right answer. Then they looked down and noticed that the article was written by one of these fellows around the table. Looked so much more authoritative when it was in print. But the ZPEB is a good place also to start. Of course, there are one or two volume dictionaries, abridgments of that. But those two encyclopedias, I think I would mention. From a purely biblical angle, doing your own research, I would suggest. Any of you have any other suggestions?
The theological word book from the Old Testament, again, some of those that may list.
Well,
look at it and see what articles are there anyway.
Yeah, well, my theological word book is not, wouldn't do that.
No,
it's just a dictionary. It's a Hebrew dictionary, really.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's so topical.
I mean, not that word topical.
This is a suggestion that I would give. Look in the back of Young's Concordance under sin. And it would have all the different words that are translated sin in the King James Version. Now that when you have a list of the words, well, then you can go and look in these other places. Standard dictionaries, of course, and also the encyclopedias, and then you can do some more concordance study of your own. And so I would suggest that you get the listing to begin with, just Young's Concordance. So for that one. Well, I think we are to go on today for Leviticus Chapter 5, wasn't it? 5:14, I think we'll begin. Now, 5:14, put it in context, we have the burnt offering first,
in chapter 1, and then the grain offering in chapter 2, the meal or meat offering in King James, the fellowship offering, which in King James is a peace offering, and then in chapter 4, the sin offering, and now in chapter 5, the guilt offering, chapter 5, 14, the guilt offering. These are the five major offerings. They're extras. The burnt offering was the one that was every morning and every night. That was a burnt offering for all Israel, and the animal was totally consumed on the altar. Now, it doesn't actually say what the burnt offering signifies. Different views are held. One of you has a paper, I think, or one paper suggested on the subject of the pre-Mosaic sacrifices when Abraham offered on the altar. My impression is that mostly it was a burnt offering, and the animal would be burnt completely, and the blood would be sprinkled and so on. We're not given too much details about pre-Mosaic sacrifices, except that they go all the way back to the gates of Eden. Cain and Abel offered sacrifices. The institution of those sacrifices is not mentioned. No place does it say that God told Adam and Eve to sacrifice, or that he told Cain and Abel to sacrifice. We assume that Adam and Eve told Cain and Abel. And we assume that God told Adam and Eve. But at least that is the first sacrifice. Of course, it's also sacrificed Noah. And Noah, when he sacrificed clean animals. He had clean animals in the ark. The clean animals, probably, we think of seven clean animals. I think there's probably seven pairs of clean animals that other viewers held. That they were, they went in two by two, but the clean animals were taken in by seven pairs instead of one pair. And one great reason for the having seven clean animals, of course, was that they would have food for the journey. It was a whole lot easier to keep meat fresh on the hoof than it was to keep it in the second story of the ark in the refrigerated section. You understand what I mean. So there was meat on the hoof in the ark, and also meat for animals for sacrifice after the trip was over. So there were a sacrifice in the days of Noah, but no details given. And then the sacrifice, of course, in the patriarchal family. A little bit more is mentioned, but again, not too much details are given. But I would suppose that most of those would be burnt offering, although some of them could be like the peace offering. The burnt offering, I think many people suggest that the burnt offering signifies especially worship. The smoke goes up. Well, it doesn't say that the smoke going up signifies worship. In a sense, I suppose all the sacrifices signify worship. Smoke goes up for all of them. I would argue that the burnt offering also signifies atonement, because it also has the hands laid on the head, remember, as we said last time, and it has the blood sprinkled in special ways, so that the burnt offering also signifies, and maybe even basically signifies, atonement. And perhaps other things as well. So the burnt offering would be that one. Now, the burnt offering was given us every morning and every evening. It was given also, of course, on special occasions. Every week, the Sabbath, you would have double burnt offerings. Specifications are all given there. And on special days, you would have, one of the days you have the 14 offerings the first day in the whole week, next day 13, next day 12, next day until you get down to 7. So on special feast days, there would be special numbers of offerings, but still the continual burnt offering, it was called Tamid, the continual burnt offering. Then the grain offering. The grain offering is the only one that does not have blood. The grain offering was associated with the other offerings. Now, in the grain offering, it says the priest shall take a handful of fine flour and oil together with all the incense and burn this as a memorial portion. And the rest of the grain offering belongs to Aaron and his sons. Most holy part of the offerings made to the Lord by fire. Well, the grain offering could be pure grain, or it could be baked, or it could be ground, and so on. The different forms of the grain offering that concern us particularly. Now, the grain offering can be perhaps compared and allied to the fellowship offering, the peace offering, as the King James puts it. The fellowship offering. Now, the fellowship offering was not specified when. You bring the fellowship offering when you please. The fellowship offering was, as remember, you lay your hands on the head of the animal and sprinkle the blood. It is part and parcel of the rest of the offerings. Atonement is there, and I presume worship is there, and so on too. But what is burned, as we had last time, is the fat that covers the inner part, kidney, and then the rest. I don't think it says here, but it says it later. The rest is taken and eaten. It is eaten. It says that the quarter is eaten by the priest. Now, there's some discussion whether that's the forequarter or the hindquarter. The King James says the right shoulder. I think the NIV says the right hind quarter, or the right haunch. I don't remember what the word is in the King James, in the NIV. We put in that, the Hebrews, if it says the leg, and you know, you've got four legs in an animal. You've got four legs, and you've got hind legs, too. What does that make? Six? Usually, you think of, regularly, if you go to the butcher, you know that the hind leg, the haunch, is the more tender meat. It's the better portion. And my guess is that aside from the meaning of the Hebrew words, the details of which sometimes escape us, if they don't distinguish between the forequarter and the hindquarter, my guess would be that the priest would get the better quarter, the hindquarter, as a representative, of course, of God. So at least one-fourth would go to the priest. What happens to the other three-quarters? Well, the other three-quarters of the animal goes to the worshiper. And that's why we call it the fellowship offering, because it is a communal meal. The worshiper and his family normally eats the peace offering, and you see some of the priest eats part of it too, and the priest, of course, has the grain offering to go with it, so he's got bread and meat. There's your food for your priest, is bread and meat, and the worshiper has this. Now, this, of course, explains one reason why you have so many offerings in some occasions. You realize that when the temple was dedicated, Solomon offered how many? 120. 1,000 rams, or lambs, wasn't it? It'd be in Kings. I take the time to look it up. Is it Kings or is it in Chronicles? I'm not quite sure. Here it is in 1 Kings, probably Chronicles also. 1 Kings 8:62, the king and all Israel with him offered sacrifices before the Lord. This is after Solomon's great prayer of dedication. Solomon offered a sacrifice of fellowship offerings to the Lord, 22,000 cattle. That's a lot of cows. And 120,000 sheep and goats. I think most people, when they read that, figure that that's impossible, or else it must have taken them all month to burn all those things. But you realize they didn't burn all those things. They ate all those things. This was just one great big barbecue. The fat was burned. And of course, fat burns well. Of course, the fat, you think of putting wood on the altar to burn the offering, and you would do that. But you'd have a whole lot less wood if you used all this fat. And even the big altar couldn't contain even the fat for all this. It must have been a blazing fire. And Solomon dedicated another part in the courtyard, you remember, and that would be burned as a secondary auxiliary altar. So that the fat of the fellowship offerings was burned that way. Meantime, the crowd around had just had a great big feast. And it was a large number of animals because it was a large number of people. They all wanted to eat somehow. Whether they had sandwiches or not, I don't know. But this is the fellowship offering. The fellowship offering sometimes special kinds. There's a thank offering, person is delivered from sickness, person got a new job, something, thank offering. That would be one of the fellowship offerings, different kinds of fellowship offerings. Or a vow, he'd offer a vow. That would be a fellowship offering. So the fellowship offering, the fat was burned, and the rest was a communal meal. And that, I think, is very obvious. Now, the fourth chapter there, the sin offering. Now, the sin offering is, think of it as the Hebrew katat, and that is true. The sin offering is, this is the word, both for sin and for sin offering. This is not unexpected. For the sin, you give the sin offering. And the same thing is true for the guilt offering, the sin offering, and the guilt offering. The guilt offering, as we have it today, is Hashem, the Hashem offering. And these two are really very similar. And we must keep it in mind today if we can find a difference. Maybe I can give a suggestion. We can check it as we go along. Actually, the different words are interchanged sometimes. I think we'll come across some places where the guilt offering is called an asham. Asham means also guilt and guilt offering. The burden of sin and the offering for sin. There are places where, in other parts of the Bible, places where it's difficult to tell which it is, whether it's the sin or the offering that is referred to. Context usually will tell. And what is the difference between these two? They both are very solemn. They both are specifically for the atonement for sin. The emphasis is on atonement. The worshiper has sinned. He brings a sacrifice. And in this sacrifice, the priest makes an atonement for the sin. Kafar is where we come to it. The PLs always use kafar. This is the emphasis that we find, and we will assign that later, the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement is built around a sin offering for all Israel. And this sin offering, this one, in special solemn instances, the blood is carried in to the temple, the tabernacle. And sprinkled, remember the Day of Atonement, sprinkled once a year before the Lord in the most holy place. That's not done for the asham, for the guilt offering. They are alike in many ways, but in this way, the sin offering takes precedence, shall we say, seems more significant, at least more solemn, and is done in special cases on the Day of Atonement. So that's one difference between them. I think the view I hold is not unusual. I think that one difference that is rather obvious if you read them through is that the guilt offering here, the guilt offering is the one that is used when the sin, shall we say, bears a price. When you can make restitution. You know, some sins, you can make restitution. Steal $500, well, you can give the $500 back. But many sins you can't make restitution. You kill a guy, you can't bring him to life again. You can give money to educate his children, but it won't bring him back. So there's some sins that you can't pay for. Old story about the, some famous place, about the priest over in Russia years and years ago when they had religion, before the Soviets and all that. A man went to the priest and offered and remarked that he had been guilty of gossiping. He had told lies about somebody. And so that was his confession. The priest said, well, tell you what you do. You take a bag of feathers, and you put a feather at the door, everyone. Boom, you told this false story. And then come back, see me. So he did. Came back, see the priest. The priest said, now go back and gather up those feathers. He said, can't gather up those feathers. Wind's blown them all over. The priest said, that's the trouble. That's the trouble with some sins. You can't. You can't pay for them. You can't gather up the feathers. You can't take back the gossip. You can't do the, undo the thing that has been done wrong many times. No blasphemy. You speak blasphemous words against God. They're spoken. You can repent, but you can't pay for them. And so that's more like this kind of a sin. But the guilt offering, if you steal something, or if you borrow something and don't pay it back, or if you probably also, if you promised the temple that you would give the 90 shekels at the end of the month and you didn't do it, like Ananias and Sapphira, you only gave 50 shekels, you know. Well, that you could pay up. You could pay the extra 40 shekels. And we will see, you do that. You make restitution and you add to it 20% fine. And that, I think, is the main difference between the sin offering and the guilt offering. Now, as I say, they overlap, and even the wording overlaps, but there is at least that difference. Any questions that you have? Now, that covers all these five main types of offering. Yes?
You mentioned the offering.
Yes.
I just wonder where you land on that.
Yeah.
Question.
Yeah. Well, it's a difficult one because we don't have all the evidence we would like. My own personal thought is, again, not unusual, but not universal. My thought is that Cain did not offer according to oil. That's a false use of the phrase, I guess. He did not use according to the commandment, that there was a commandment, and Cain did not do it. Cain gave a gift, and Abel offered a sacrifice. Now, some say there's no difference between them. They both offered a sacrifice, but that Abel was a good man, did it with a good heart, and Cain was an evil man, did it with an evil heart. Now, I'm sure that's true, too. But the man who had the evil heart showed it in violating the right commands of the offering. He brought an offering that was not acceptable, and not acceptable because of the bad heart, but also because of the bad sacrifice. So that's where I would come down on that argument. But it is back and forth because we don't have all the statements the Bible doesn't say. You have to go in general principles. You all get the question. Do you have any comments on that? It assumes that Adam and Eve knew something about what sacrifices were for. What is it that we call the Protevangelium? What is it? Genesis 3:15, and what does it say? The seed of the woman shall bruise his head, and he shall bruise his heel. Yes, we take this as a messianic verse, and I think rightly so. I think that it's correct. The devil, not the seed of the devil himself, will be conquered, not by the woman, but by the seed of the woman. The seed of the woman will conquer the devil himself in the long run. I think it is a messianic passage. No, it doesn't give details, but I think the teaching is there. But I like to point out that side by side with the promised Messiah, there is apparently the beginning of what they call the scarlet line of redemption. The that runs through from the gates of paradise on down to Revelation. So don't think that Genesis 3:15 is the only early messianic verse. Another early messianic verse would be the sacrifice of Abel. Now, did Abel really know what he was doing? How do we know? I presume he did. Apparently God knew what he was doing and accepted it. And Abel's sacrifice is not to be considered by itself. It's to be considered in connection with all the other sacrifices that follow it. And they are one of a kind. So I say that the sacrificial system really is a messianic teaching. Now, that's debated and all, but we'll keep that in mind as we go on to other matters. Well, I think we're about ready for the translation. Any other questions or general points? Well, yes. Oh, yeah, well, that's a good question. This is a question of translation. My wife brings up whether or not sin lies at the door. And the word is raves there. Well, there's a difference. I'm talking about different ones. Raves is the word to lie. And the question is it to lie at the door or is it to crouch at the door? And you have then the word sin, and it's a chatat, isn't it, Anne?
Yes.
A chatat. And is a chatat, is it sin, is crouching at the door, ready to get you? Or is it a sin offering, is lying at the door, ready for you to give? Is it two possibilities? And the word ravas, is kind of a key to it, but raves does mean sometimes lie, sometimes means spring crouch like a lion. So, again, there are two sides, and which side do you come down on that particular question? It is attractive to think that it means that God says to him that there is a sin offering available if you will change your mind. I mean, he's offering Cain a second chance. Cain had sinned greatly. The Lord offered him redemption, and he wouldn't take it. His answer was defiant. And not my brother's keeper, and so on. So I rather favor, but it's hard to prove, the idea that Christ, that God there was telling him that there is a sin offering available. And so this would strengthen the idea that here we have the beginning of that scarlet line, which is indeed a messianic prophecy in the Old Testament. Good, brother.
Is there anything in the statement that Abel gave the first fruits of the flock in the exact portions of his offering to the Lord, and Cain did not?
What does it say about Cain?
Find it here. Says that Abel kept flock and came with soil, and the time came was some of the fruits of the soil as an offering.
Uh-huh.
Some of the fruits of the soil.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we talk about that being part of the fellowship offering that you offer, but we didn't really comment on the fat, the nature of the significance of the fat.
The word fat in the Hebrew is used sometimes, I guess, in other languages. The word fat is used to mean rich, best, wealthy, so on. The King James says that a man who loves the Lord will be in his old age, he will be fat and flourishing. I never took that as a promise exactly in detail, and to be fat and flourishing. it means to be flourishing. The fat of the land is not grease. The fat of the land is the best of the land, you see. And so when it says that Cain brought the fat of the offering I don't think that it means he brought only the fat to burn as in the fellowship, but that he brought the best of the lamb, the best of the flock. And that's true. That shows, of course, the dedicated heart of Abel. Whereas Cain, it does not, I guess it does not say that he brought the first fruits of the land, does it? It just says he brought some of the fruits of the land.
It does say of Abel, it says fat portions.
Fat portions, yeah.
So I don't have to.
Yeah, I don't know. We have the Hebrew here, whether we take time to look it up or not. But it does not emphasize that Cain brought the best. So it is, I think it's quite true. I would not deny at all that Abel had the unsaved heart and the unsaved heart's attitude, and Abel had the saved heart's attitude. And so attitude is part of the reason God did not accept it, but the attitude showed itself also, I think, in bringing a false sacrament. But Cain didn't care. Abel did.
There was
revelation.
Yeah.
Yes, Noah.
We don't have
the revelation, but Noah obviously did do that according to revelation. Yes. Unless, of course, you remember that particular portion of the flood story is in the P document, which was done in 450 B.C., you know.
Yeah. That explains everything. Well, then we turn, I think, if nothing else, to Leviticus 5:14. It was, wasn't it? Leviticus 5:14. Mr. Kwon Jung Kim? 5:14. Did you apparently went up on me, please? Ayikra. The Yikra is for Leviticus, isn't it? Notice that I really would like to say Vayikra. Some people say Vayikra. The Hebrew does not have a V, but so many scholars were Jewish and German, and the Jewish scholars lived in Germany, and German has no W, so they pronounce the wow as a V. And so in Israel today, because of German influence, the wow is a V. So some will call it Vayikra, but I think that probably better would be Vayikra. 5:14. Okay, Mr. Kim. Yes. Verse 14, yes. Oh, just translate. Don't bother to read.
And Yahweh said to Moses.
Yes. Let me take off on one little point there. It is very common these days to say Yahweh, and I don't object to your saying it. But let's think a little bit about that word Yahweh. Of course, the King James has Jehovah. You all know that Jehovah is wrong. The Hebrew, in the days of Christ, refused to use the sacred name. Even in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, when they're writing in Aramaic, and they come to the sacred name, when they're writing in the square characters, like ours, they come to the sacred name, they'll write it in the old characters, in the old Paleo-Hebrew characters, the reverence they had for the name. But even a strange thing in the book of Isaiah, this is full of Isaiah, where you have the Hebrew letters come along like this, and the word Jehovah comes, and then you have four dots, and then the text goes on like this. Why four dots?
It seems clear that the scribes,
before they would write the sacred name, they would wash their hands, change the pen, do something, you know, to make it sacred. And to do that nine times in the morning is important. So they would come along, and when they came to a place where it was a tetragram, they would put in four dots. And then, at the end of the morning, just before the noon bell, they would wash their hands, take a new pen, and go back and
fill in the sacred name 9 times. So they would wash their hands once instead of 9 times and hold our supper. That's curious. And once or twice they forgot. But the poor died.
So it seemed.
At least it does seem that the scribes about that time did not use the sacred name. And this is an important point in the New Testament. In the New Testament, you remember Christ before the high priest? The high priest says, I charge thee that art thou the Christ, the Son of, what's it say? Art thou the Christ, the Son of? No. The Blessed One. Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Now, why did he say that? Why didn't he say, art thou the Christ, the Son of God? He would use the sacred name. And Jesus answered, he said, I am. And you shall see the Son of Man coming on the right hand of what? Power. Coming on the right hand of power. He didn't use the sacred name either. Jesus was not going to go to the cross on a technicality. It would have been technical blasphemy, you see. And he avoided it. And the phrase kingdom of heaven in the book of St. Matthew is probably that sort of thing instead of kingdom of God in the other gospels. The gospel for the Jews was the kingdom of heaven. And the two are equivalent. So they avoided the sacred name. And then instead they pronounced the word Adonai. And Adonai has, you know, like this. Adonai or Adonai. And so they take the Shua from here and put it on here, Olam from here and put it on here, Talmud from here and put it on here, and pronounce Adonai. Although it says tetragram. Now, the name Jehovah is a combination of this false combination of these two. So you all know that Jehovah is wrong. So, modern scholars trying to get the name of God. Say that this is not right, and of course it isn't. And so we'll start fresh. And it says in the book of Exodus, it says, I am that I am. This is the word Hayah. Here we have the word Hayah. And Yeh would be the word. And so they write it Yahweh. Yahweh. I don't know whether they have a comma or Yahweh, like that. And that's where the word Yahweh comes from. Any questions on that? You see what it is. The question now is that right? Is that right? Now, I had up here something else first. I had Yahweh, didn't I? Yahweh. If you have the name Hayah, the prefix would be Yah, wouldn't it? Yikto. Yahweh. Well, the answer is that Yiktol, you've learned the third masculine singular imperfect capital, Yiktol. Yiktol is not the ancient pronunciation. The ancient pronunciation very clearly is Yiktol. There's been a shift in Hebrew between the path and certain cases when you hear it. The hippio used to be hactil instead of hictil. That same Pathahiric shift. So the old usage was that. The trick, however, is that the old usage was not this. This is a later form. In Ugaritic, you don't have any of that. In Ugaritic, you have this all right, but you don't have this. This came later. Alamate verb like bana in Ugaritic is in the perfect banaya, with an overhanging vowel, and the imperfect, it would be yavnaya. Yavnaya. And it would not be yet to go hey. So Yahweh, as you find it in all the books these days, is a mixture of an early pata and a late sigol. And really, it's not correct either. Go ahead and use it if you like. I don't know what else to use, but
remember that it's not correct. Yes.
Could you explain again why Jehovah
it is a combination of the vowels of this word and the consonants of this word. And the Jews did not pronounce it Jehovah. They did not pronounce this at all. They pronounced Adonai instead of this. And so you have a hybrid made up of two unpronounceable things. Well, let me say one more thing on this. In Exodus 3, it says, I will be who I will be, or I am who I am. Say, I am have sent you. And it seems as if this is the verb Hayah. But please remember that the Old Testament is full, not so much of etymology, but a wordplay. Is that right? The Old Testament had many wordplays. For instance, it says also in Genesis, it says with the power of Babel. The power of Babel. There. And this is why they call it the Tower of Babel, because there God confounded the tongues. And confounding the tongues is the Hebrew word balal. Now, how do you get Babel out of Balal? My teacher, seminary, Dr. O.T. Ellis, fine man, true scholar, and he really sweat blood trying to get Balal out of Balal, but you can't do it. And the critics used to say, here's a mistake, you see. But I don't think anybody says it's a mistake anymore. It's a wordplay. It isn't derived from this, but it sounds like this. Sometimes it sounds exactly like this. Sometimes it sounds approximately like this. But it is just a wordplay. I roll in the dust, old city of Ophrah, says in Micah. Well, Ophrah, Afar, the wordplay. City, Ophrah, sounds like Afar, for dust. Now, there's a wordplay. And it does it all along. We call that place the Beersheba. Beersheba, what does it mean? Well, of the seven. So you lambs there. And suppose we found it meant Beersheba 100 years before Abraham. Would it make any difference? No. Abraham was not inventing a name. He was making a play on the name Beersheba. And if that is true, how do we know that this comes from the verb Hayah anyhow? It may well be a play on the name Hayah, see? And have nothing to do with the third masculine singular imperfect. My own feeling is that Yod Hey Well, which we trace back to a pretty early time, around 800 in inscription, that those are not vowels anyhow, that those are consonants. You should have a word with four syllables. If you get a word with four syllables out of that, turns out almost like Jehovah after all. So the word Yahweh, I don't object to using it, but I think we should realize that it's probably not any more correct than the word Yahweh, not any more correct than the word Jehovah. You can use Yahweh, or we just say the Lord, or of course, you know what the modern Jews say, Hashem, the name. They even go that far. Adonai is possible too. But I don't object to what you said. I just wanted to get the background and picture. So, all right, Yahweh or Jehovah, the Lord said unto Moses, spoken to Moses, saying, take next also, Mr. Kim.
And
Moses
commenced upon the place and
Yes, now let's go over that again. A man who, now this is Tim'al Ma'al, Tim'ol Ma'al, a man who does something and sins. What do you suppose it is that he has done? I suppose it's general. A man who sins, Ma'al,
This would be one of the words, you know, one of the words of sin. What is the nuance of this word? And it's usually said that this is that he proves unfaithful. Now, what does it mean he proves unfaithful? Maybe it means that he does not bring right sacrifice. Or maybe he didn't bring any sacrifice that week at all. Or something else. He proves unfaithful. The King James says, commits a violation. The NIV says, commits a violation. It's really hard to know the detail of the type of sin. I suppose maybe it's general. Commits any violation of the tabernacle ordinances or of the religious ordinances. It is quite possible that it is talking here about a religious offense rather than a physical offense. This is not, you know, like a fellow hit him in the eye or something. This is something in the tabernacle with regard to any of the Lord's holy things, it says in the end there. That would be Tim Ol Ma'al. Of course, you have their cognate accusative. It'd be Ma'al the Ma'al. And he sins in. Now, then this next word is, Bishagaga. And how do you take Bishagaga, Mr. Kim? I didn't get your translation. Inadvertently. Inadvertently. That was your statement? What's it mean, inadvertently? The King James says, what is the King James? I looked it up, it slipped me. That's a violation. In ignorance? In ignorance. I think it uses inadvertent sometimes too. But
ignorantly.
I think maybe it says. Now, you see, there's a lot of discussion about this. The NIV says, add it here, unintentionally. This is an unintentional sin. We had at our church last night a good brother, a converted Jewish fellow, and he made the remark that the unintentional sins could be atoned for. But he said that the intentional sins, there was no sacrifice in the Old Testament for an intentional sin. Now, that's a rather common view. But that's a pretty serious statement. Because an awful lot of sins are intentional, aren't they? Goes on down to in chapter 6, it speaks about somebody who finds lost property and lies about it. I suppose that's intentional. It says if something's left in his care and stolen, or if he cheats somebody, that sounds pretty intentional. But there is a sacrifice allowed for that. And so the idea that the Old Testament had no sacrifice for an intentional sin, and that this was only unintentional sins that were could be atoned for. That's a pretty serious statement, don't you think? And it hangs on this word, shagaga. If shagaga means unintentional, or if it means ignorance, or if it means, there's another possibility, unintentional, ignorance, unwitting. I think King James sometimes uses unwitting. That would be pretty much ignorance. Ignorance and unwitting. Yeah. So, this is question. Now, the next question, of course, that I ask you is, how do you know? How do you find out? I'm interested in method here. How do you find out what shagaga means? Now, will you answer this question? What would you say? What did you do to find shagaga, Mr. Kim? You looked it up in the lexicon? Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, you see, BDB is a good place to start. Right? BDB is all right, of course. Now, I don't mind too much, you know, if you look at the King James or the Bible or the NIV or NASB or something, so long as you don't trust it too much and you want to check for yourself. But to know in the general area what it means, BDB is all right. I had recommended also Kerber Baumgartner. Kerber Baumgartner on this subject would probably be no better. It does not use, I did check it, it is not used in Ugaritic, and it is not used in Arabic. If it were used in Arabic, BDB would tell you. If it were used in Akkadian, Kerber Baumgartner would have a better chance than this. BDB will sometimes give you an Akkadian parallel, but mainly the Arabic. Now, there's a story back in that movie, I'll tell you. And then we'll stop for about 5 minutes. The Semitists of 1890 or 1905, like BDB, they didn't have much of Babylonian, Assyrian, we call it Akkadian, to go on. They didn't have, of course, any Ugaritic. The Amarna tablets had just barely been discovered in the 1890s. And a lot they did not know, but they knew Arabic. And if a word were found in Arabic, then you could tell what it meant. The thing to do was to learn Arabic. And BDB will have an Arabic equivalent for most everything. And that's not difficult, because Arabic has an enormous vocabulary. And you look at a modern Arabic grammar or a dictionary, and you will most always find some parallel to your Hebrew word. What do you think of the method? How would that really work? What is the Arabic that you find in a modern dictionary? Modern Arabic, wouldn't it? Here's modern Arabic. What are you comparing it with? Ancient Hebrew. A different language and a vastly different period. We have no Arabic of consequence before Muhammad. 700. 620 in the before that, we don't have any contemporary Arabic to the New Testament or contemporary Arabic to the Old Testament. Some old South Arabic inscriptions. But what we call Arabic, North Arabic, is not an ancient language. And yet much of the commentators of those days were built on parallels to the Arabic. And I just point out that the methodology is wrong. Much better to go from the Hebrew to the ancient Akkadian, as the Akkadian is a sister language. Well, the word Akkadian, the word for king in Hebrew is tsar, one word for king, the word for king in Akkadian is sharu. It's the same language. It's a sister language, just like Portuguese and Spanish are closer. I guess it would be better to say like German and English. These two, the Akkadian. And so if you find a word in Akkadian, and it has a large vocabulary, a million or so clay tablets have been found with lots and lots of words. The Akkadian vocabulary is very extensive. And so whereas a person used to have to know Akkadian, used to have to know Arabic, now he has to know Akkadian. So the Akkadian would be a parallel. On the other hand, you have to watch out when you go from one language to another. If you go, I mentioned German and English. In German, you have the word for boy. The word for boy in German is Knabe. The word for Knabe, boy. Do we have that word in English? Yes. It's boy in German. It's bad boy in English. See that? From one language to another, it has changed meaning. And you want to be pretty careful when you go from one language to another. And so it is when going from Hebrew to Akkadian. From Akkadian to Hebrew. Sometimes the best you can do.
But you have to be careful. You mustn't just take a word in Akkadian and say, this is what it is, and so put it here. Well, this is on method, and I've run over. So it's supposed to take 10 minutes.